Okay, this is John's Gospel part, I don't know, lost count, six, I think. Previously, in John's Gospel, we have done an introductory session. We've looked at the prologue. We've said that John used that to introduce a lot of key themes. We looked at what is John's Gospel, in other words, what is the good news according to John, and we looked at Jesus' relationship with Judaism and the way that John portrays that as found wanting to quite a high degree. And then last time we asked the question, how does John portray Jesus as God? And as we might have expected, although he does come right out and say it's all done in kind of clever ways and allusions and so on. So we come to the last one tonight, which is a bit of an add-on in that it was only going to be five, but by popular demand, I've been enabled to do another one. And I've called this tonight Signs and Sayings. The brief really was to look at the seven signs in John's Gospel. But I will be doing a little bit on the sayings as they relate to the signs. And I remember right at the start causing controversy by saying there are no miracles in John's Gospel. And people quite rightly said, what about feeding the 5,000 and what have you? But as we'll see in a moment, they're not miracles as such, and we'll see in a little bit more detail why they're not miracles as such. So let's begin by talking about what the seven signs are, although you'll see already from that heading that it's unclear. We like to think there are seven signs, but actually there are as many as nine there. It depends what you count, really, as a sign. So, see if you can tell me these in order. You may need to flip through your pages to find out. The first one is easy because John says
this is the first sign.
So that was, okay, that was the wedding at Cana, Jesus turning water into wine, chapter 2. Yep,
four.
It is indeed. And it is, okay, healing the official's son, just a few verses at the back end of chapter 4. Mm-hmm. And again, John says that's the second sign, yeah. Okay. Number 3, probably Bethesda, beginning of chapter 5, yeah. Number 4, feeding the 5,000. In chapter 6. And number 5 is walking on water or not. And not that he kind of sunk, but what I mean by that is that some people include that in as part of the feeding of the 5,000. Because they want to get another one at the end, so they have to put those two together. I'm not convinced personally, so I'm going to treat that as a separate thing, but just note that. Yeah, next one. We have spent quite a bit of time on this one already in the series. It's the man born blind in chapter 9.
Yeah.
And number 7, Lazarus in chapter 11. So that's your seven signs. But some people say, well, you haven't included the most significant sign of all, which is the resurrection. So under this numbering, that would be number 8, which would rather mess up the seven signs. So let's put the feeding of 5,000 and the walking on the water together. And then you've got, and the synoptics link it pretty closely. Mm-hmm. So then you've got your seven signs, the culmination of which is the resurrection. Because it's a magic number. But what messes that idea up is that there is yet another one, which is what happens after the resurrection. No, you said it, Chris. It's the catch of fish in chapter 21. So, take your pick, really. And and as we say, scholars handle that by saying, well, there are seven. Really, the resurrection is the climax, number seven, but we need to put four and five together. Other people still want the resurrection, but say John does seven signs and then the biggie.
Right, yeah.
But that's rather messed up by number nine. So, hey, we don't know, do we? But they're all things that happened, but not miracles. So what is the difference between a miracle in the synoptics and a sign in John? And it isn't just, what's in a name, as it were. I think there is a significant difference between Jesus doing miracles in the synoptics and Jesus doing signs in John. Anyone want to... That's quite an obscure question, but anyone want to have a go at trying to answer that? What is happening when in the synoptics Jesus does a miracle? How is that presented by the synoptic writers? What's actually going on? Okay, yeah, that's a good answer. It's not wrong. As the name sign suggests, it wants to point to something.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, okay. It's a description of what happened. What did happen? Okay, does it link back to something in the past? A couple of times it does, certainly. We're going to see that as we go through this. Okay, let's take, for example, someone being healed in the synoptics. Pick a miracle, any miracle. What is going on there, and for and to whom? So, okay, let's get a bit more specific. Luke 13, the bent over woman in the middle of Luke 13. Okay, what's happening is that she gets healed.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But what is happening on a kind of bigger level? Yeah, okay, that's certainly true that miracle is about the Sabbath, but that's not exactly what I'm after here. What happens to the woman? Yeah, she's healed. But at a more kind of cosmic level. Right, now we're getting there. Yep. So a bit more. What is happening when Jesus does those kind of miracles? Power of God is revealed and people believe. We're almost...
People are divided.
Yeah. No. Yeah, all that's true. The miracles in the synoptics are actual inbreakings of the kingdom of God. Sickness is banished.
Right.
Demons are driven out.
The dead are raised.
The dead are raised. A bit of Satan's work is undone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, for example, Luke 11:20. So this woman is set free from her infirmity, but ground is taken for the kingdom of God.
Right.
Yeah. And every miracle is a little step that weakens the power of Satan and demonstrates God's kingdom. So Luke 11:20 says, so it's great if you're the person who gets set free from demons, but that's hardly the point on one level. The point is that the kingdom is breaking in. And again, 13:16, that's the passage we looked at. This woman whom Satan has bound is set free.
Yeah.
So it's the advance of the kingdom of God. And when Jesus does miracles in the synoptics, he's clawing back ground from Satan. Yeah? That's the significance of a miracle. But the signs in John are not primarily about that. They are, as the name says, signs pointing towards the kingdom of God. So it's not an actual, well, it is, but John doesn't portray it as an actual inbreaking of the kingdom of God, but rather this is how it's going to be when the kingdom of God comes. Mm. Yeah? Mm. So it's deeper than just a series of one-off advances for the kingdom. It is signs pointing towards what it's going to be like when the kingdom is here in all its fullness. And I think if we read the signs in that light, that will help us then to ask the question, which we'll ask in a minute, okay, so how will it be? And what is this sign telling us about that? Okay, makes sense. One more thing about the signs in John. And we would expect this. Do you remember when we talked about what John's gospel was? What was the gist of that evening? That's it. It's the contrasting opposites and the fact that you need to choose. Yeah? Yeah? Yes. And there's no middle ground. And the signs continue that. They always provoke that crisis, and you know that the Greek word crisis means make your mind up time, like off that whatever that old program was on the telly. It's a crossroads moment when you need to choose which way you're going to do. And for most of the signs, you will see some comment about that. So after the wedding at Cana, they believe and they put their trust in him. After the blind man, there's division and arguments going on for the rest of the chapter. Okay? Mm-hmm. Just a quick look at the terminology. We've already said that the synoptics use the word miracles, and the word is dunamis, which is where we get dynamite from. It's acts of power. And again, that ties in with that inbreaking thing. Jesus himself in John doesn't use the word signs. He uses the word erga, which means works. But John, yeah, that's right. And an erg, if you do physics, an erg is a unit of work, isn't it? So there we are. So that's what Jesus does. But John refers to them as signs. Semeia, that's where we get semiotics from, the study of signs and symbols. And the other thing, and Chris pointed this out quite rightly earlier on, the other thing you often get in John is a sign followed by a discourse. And he does it a lot, but the classic one is the 5,000 and the bread of life discourse. And sometimes the saying, I am the bread of life, comes out of a miracle. Yeah? So that's just all by way of background. But what we're looking for is to ask the question, how does this sign say it will be when the kingdom is here? What is it pointing to about that? Now, classic question, I ask it every week. Where are we going to start in this study? And you're going to say, in the prologue, and I'm going to say, no. our starting verse, or two of them, are right at the end. Remember we said John's got two endings, because it looks like chapter 21 was tagged on later. But both of them end with a very similar thing. Someone like to read those couple of verses to us. Okay, and the second one. What does that tell us about the seven or eight or nine signs? They're a small example. And what question does that raise? Yeah, why though? Why did John choose those particular ones out of all the stuff that Jesus did? So that's what we're going to try and have a look at. But being as how we don't know what most of the others were, we haven't got much to compare it with other than some of the synoptic stuff, but we'll see how that works out. Now, just final bit of background to this, and we probably should have done this slightly earlier actually in the course, but it's helpful, I think, to break down John's Gospel into one writer calls it a sort of play. So you've got an overture, and you know, if you go to a music hall, the overture is an instrumental piece which introduces some of the songs which you're going to have to suffer, which you're going to listen later on. So it's some little tasters, yeah?
Yes.
And I think we've already seen that the prologue functions in that way. He doesn't develop the tunes, he just quotes them, and then when we come back to them, we can say, oh yeah, we heard a bit of that earlier on. Then you've got Act 1, which is the revelation of the Word, and Jesus is being shown for who he is. We talked about that, didn't we, about divine and human, but he's also showing through the signs. We said what the kingdom is going to be like. But then Act 2 is the glorification of the Word. And do you remember the Greek hupsoo, which means lifted up, but also glorified? And the turning point really is after Lazarus. And I think coming back to that list, there is some rationale for saying that there are seven signs in Act 1. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then in Act 2, there are no more miraculous signs, A, which are called that, although not all the seven are, but they're not like stuff that Jesus does to other people, like healing them or whatever. So it's almost like you've got the miracle stories and then the passion narrative, rather like you've got in the synoptics. And then finally at the end you've got the epilogue, chapter 21, which may or may not have been part of the original work, but it just kind of rounds stuff off for us. So therefore what we're looking at in this section is mainly Act 1. That's the bit of the play that has the kind of signs in. So let's have a look at the wedding at Cana. In chapter 2, we won't read through all these. You may want to go home and do that a little bit more at your leisure. We know the stories in outline, but I just want to pick out from each of them some little pointers to what it is that this sign might be saying. First of all, John tells us in verse 11 that this was the first sign, and we usually take that to mean the first chronologically, which it obviously was, but the Greek could also mean the primary one, and in a sense all the others are outworkings or commentary on this one. Yeah, so we need to listen particularly to this one, and it's interesting with this to ask the question, what would different people have got out of it? So the Jews, for example, would immediately or probably have thought back to Isaiah 25, if someone would like to read that passage. Okay, in that day they will say, what day is that? The day of the Lord in the Old Testament. I don't know if we've talked about that, but that was the day that everyone was looking forward to when God was going to come and sort everything out, right? So it's a picture of both the coming of the Messiah, who was going to be the one through whom God was going to sort everything out, and also the kind of end of time later on. In their thinking, the beginning of the new age. Mm-hmm. So when they see Jesus at a feast providing wine, that's obviously got some allusions there. Mm-hmm. And that's just another way of John saying, mm-hmm, Jesus is the Messiah. Mm-hmm. But also Jesus is God, because it is God who's going to provide. So you've got that bit of background to it. But what about the Greeks? And our old friend Philo, who we met, do you remember, who was the... he was a Jew who was very influenced by Greek philosophy. And he talked about the Logos, yeah? Mm-hmm. As the kind of utterance of God in the world, God's will being worked out in the world. But there are some passages in Philo in which he talks about the Logos as the wine giver, but also the wine who is given. Hold that thought, because we're going to come back to that in a moment. But again, there's allusions there, and John is pulling out of the culture and saying this Logos, this giver of wine and the wine itself, is Jesus. And then if you were a pagan, of course, the god of wine is Dionysus or Bacchus. I remember when I was a student at college, we had a bottle of wine and it had a picture of Bacchus on the label, looking really like debauched and everything. I remember cutting it out and sticking it on my student union card in place of my photo. But, we've all seen that kind of image of the provider of wine and the god of partying and general debauchery, and actually to see that being worked out by someone who is nevertheless sinless is a really kind of thing. So Jesus is pointing, when this kingdom does come, when the day of the Lord does come, it's going to be all of this, but in a good way. Yeah, that's what he's saying, I think, through that sign. And the bottom line is about abundance and joy, not just water turning into wine, but the best wine. Yeah, not the cheapo stuff. So and loads of it as well. So without going into it in any depth at all, just skimming the surface, there's loads of stuff there that John is pointing us to in what is a very simple domestic miracle, but it would have set all sorts of bells ringing for people. Okay, much more quickly and much more simply, the official son. Now, we won't do this, but if you read those passages in Matthew 8 and Luke 7, you've got a very similar story. And it's probably the same incident, but being John, he's going to tell it his way for his purposes. So what's his spin on this? And if you look in 450, there's an interesting piece of phraseology there. This is 49. The royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." "Go," Jesus replies, "your son will live." Now, if you were Jesus and someone came to you and said, "Come down before my child dies," what would you probably say? "Don't worry, he's going to get better, it'll be all right, he won't die." But John has Jesus deliberately saying, "Your son will live." And if you go back to the prologue in 1:4, in Jesus is life.
Yeah.
"Your son will live," not "your son will be healed." That's what the synoptics would have said. It's bigger than that. It's in Jesus there is going to be life. There's another, we did touch on this in a previous week, but there is another, I think, significant thing about this. What do we know about the official? And certainly that's brought out in the synoptics account of this. Who was he? Do we know? Yeah, he's a Gentile. That's the key.
Right.
That's the key thing. And you remember we talked about the progression which you find in Acts chapter 1, mm-hmm. verse 8, Jerusalem. Where the gospel's going to go. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, ends of the earth. Now, where has Jesus started in chapter 2? Galilee, a Jewish wedding, right? Then who does he meet shortly after in chapter 4? The Samaritan woman. And we said, do you remember, it's a bit like the Welsh, you know. Now he's doing it for a Gentile. And John, I think, is wanting to say, as Luke is wanting to say in Acts, this is for everyone. Always has been. Right back to Abraham. All nations will be blessed through you.
Yes.
And the Jews have constantly wanted to be a special evening. You look, don't really count. So I think John, very early in the first four chapters of his gospel, he's already said that in the prologue for all people, but now he's actually living that out. Yep. Paul of Bethesda, chapter 5, quite an interesting one here. Again, you've got a parallel in Mark's gospel. But what's interesting here, some people believe, is some of the numbers involved. Now, what can you see there in terms of numbers? He'd been ill for 38 years, colonnades around the pool, and 38 years of illness. What's that make you think of? Or what might it have made you think of if you were a Jew with a convoluted mind? What's five about for the Jews? Yeah. The Torah, the law, five books of Moses, first five books of our Old Testament. So is there an allusion there to the law? Question. What about 38 years? Yeah, wandering in the desert, 38 years. You know, our ears are beginning to pluck up. And then, what does he say in verse 7? Really significant phrase there. Why can't he get healed? I have no one to help me. Now, could it be that this is about the inadequacy of the Jewish law? There are five things which are meant to do you good and to bless you. But this guy has been sat there for 38 years because he's got no one to help him. The structures are there, but without that actual help of someone coming alongside him, he just can't make it. Now, if that isn't a picture of Judaism at the time of Jesus, you know, they've got all these laws, and Jesus says, doesn't he, to the Pharisees in Matthew, you're blind guides. You just won't lift a finger to help anyone. You do all your wonderful study and your teaching, but you're not actually helping people to get into the kingdom of God. And Jesus cuts through all that and just does it and just heals him. And you can see how that in particular could be a further commentary on the water into wine thing. Judaism just, you know, ain't going to do it. You need more help than that.
Yeah.
And we're going to discover, of course, later on, that that help is the Spirit whom Jesus is going to give. Okay, yeah. So his quotes, so wandering, fits, was actually it? Being sat there stuck.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And in a sense, it was only a short distance to the water, just as it wasn't that long. If they'd have gone straight away to the promised land, they would have got there in, you know, fairly short time. And then, we touched on this, you've got the controversy afterwards, because someone obviously gets it. Someone gets what Jesus is trying to do. And again, it's the Sabbath. Do you remember we said last time, we have a law, they say to Jesus, and there's that incompatibility. You're doing this, you're setting people free on the Sabbath. And again, that points to the uselessness of the Jewish situation to do any good to anyone. One thing I should have said last time, which I just remembered when I was preparing this, whenever Jesus refers to the law, he says your law is always yours. Yeah, I think he's trying to distance himself from it, really. It's like a married couple, you say your mother or your naughty son. One of the things I wondered about doing after we'd done this was to go through Galatians, which would have answered that question perfectly. Okay. If Jesus is so down on it, what was the point of having it in the first place? And just a trail for when we do that, the law wasn't given to make us good. It was given to show us how bad we are and to stop us being worse. And I always think of a speed limit. If it says 70, that shows me how bad I am, because I constantly want to go faster than that, or I did till I did my IAM. But if it wasn't there, like when I was in Germany, I did 125 over there, and that's fine. Anyway, that's a complex question about which there is a whole book of the New Testament. But for John's purposes, there's nothing good about it at all. It's oppressive and it's useless. And you cannot get through those five porticos without someone to help you. And when someone does help you, you don't need the porticos, the water, nothing. Okay? Feeding of 5,000, sometimes it's useful to note when and where John says things are going to happen. And in 6:4, John gives us a clue as to what this sign is going to point to. Can you spot that?
Passover.
So immediately he set it in that kind of context. We're not talking about the law now, or the wilderness wanderings. We're talking particularly about the Passover. And what does Jesus do? He feeds people with bread. Now, who else has fed people with bread, do we think? Through person?
Moses.
Yeah, that's right. He has... Moses was the one who fed the people with bread in the past. And what's more, if you look in Deuteronomy 18:15, which I'm sure you do most days, I'm allowed to read Deuteronomy 18:15. Okay. And I think we've touched on this before, haven't we? The prophet like Moses. And sometimes the Jews asked Jesus, didn't they? They asked John the Baptist, didn't they, in chapter 1? Are you Elijah? Are you the prophet like Moses? Now, here's a guy who is known to be a prophet, suddenly starts feeding people with bread. Aha, they begin to think. And you've got here, he does the miracle, it's straightforward, it's in all four of the Gospels. But again, John teaches on the back of it with a discourse. And the discourse is about the bread of life, I am the bread of life. And there is a fascinating, I discovered this when I was doing my MA on John's Gospel. If you look at Exodus 16:15, someone like to read that for us, please. This is the manna. There's an obscure piece of scholarship based on an Aramaic text which suggests that rather than saying, what is it, they are saying, who is it? Who is this Moses? And you remember we had Jesus and the ladder, and it could mean Jesus is the one that the angels are coming to visit, as it were, but it could also mean Jesus is the ladder. And there was a tradition that grew up, and it's a bit obscure and it's not very widely attested, but there is a tradition that says, that's identified Moses with the manna. Now, don't ask me how that works at all. Until you get to hear. And Jesus is not just the provider of bread. I am the bread. Now, do you remember we said that about the Logos as the wine giver and the wine? Now, we don't know whether that was a popular understanding among the Jews. It is a bit obscure, but suddenly it becomes a possibility, doesn't it, from what we know? We said about Philo's Logos as the wine giver. So maybe Jesus saying, I am the bread of life, had an antecedent in Moses and his identification with the manna. So clearly Jesus is saying that, but he might just be alluding back to a rather obscure kind of Jewish legend, which may or may not have rung some bells for them. So again, we haven't got time to go into that whole discourse, but you've got, clearly this is a prophet like Moses, but totally unlike Moses, because he needed to keep on doing it, manna every day. Jesus is just it. Yeah. Which again rings bells back to the woman at the well. Give me this water so I won't have to keep coming in. The water that I give will be... Right, anyway, you get the idea. Let's just whiz really quickly. Walking on water, slightly strange, didn't do a lot, obviously, the synoptics, but there are a couple of Old Testament references to God planting his footsteps in the sea and walking across. So it may be there another Jesus is God reference. And interestingly, when in 6:20 they see him and they're afraid, our Bibles say something like, don't worry, it's me. And that it is I in Greek is ego eimi, I am, name of God. The blind man, again, we talked about that, new creation, light and darkness. And Jesus tags on the back of that the saying and the discourse, I am the light of the world. And I wonder whether, because then you go on to this great argument with the Pharisees, which gets actually quite abusive. And I wonder whether John has put that in there as a kind of warning for those who do choose the light, that it's a bit like take up your cross and follow me in the synoptics. This ain't going to be easy, folks. You can see, and you've got to stay sure-footed, but don't expect that you're not going to be attacked. Mm-hmm. And they're blind. They don't get it. They've chosen the wrong side. But nevertheless, that's still going to happen for you there. And then finally, Lazarus. Jesus' power over death, obviously pointing towards his own resurrection. And then the discourse which follows that, only a short one, but that challenge as well, where he says to the ladies, I am the resurrection and the life, da, da, da. Do you believe this? Often preach on that text at funerals, and that challenge is there to be on the right side of things. The catch of fish, again, you've got clear parallels in Luke 5, almost certainly the same incident, but John's spinning it. And it's interesting, it's about Peter. When Luke tells the story, Peter is being commissioned as an evangelist. Yeah, you will go and catch people. In John, Peter's commissioned as a pastor, feed my sheep, look after my lambs. That kind of thing. So whether it's better to be a pastor or an evangelist, and that's a step up, but it's a reminder, I think, in the church that we need both. And if you have evangelists without pastors, they just drop off. Mm-hmm. If you have pastors with evangelists, they end up pastoring the same few people. So is there something there about the fruitfulness of the church? And a really big question, and I'm not going to do this because it will take hours, but why 153 fish? And I have a sheet there of possible explanations all about triangular numbers and gematria and all sorts, and that's something that scholars down the years have studied forever. If you add up the first 17 numbers, 1 plus 2 plus 3, you get 173. There's something else, and if you cube it, I multiply it by the Trinity and then multiply it by the Trinity again, it comes to 153. 1 to 17, which is the sum that makes 153, people have said, well, 17 is 10 commandments and the 7 spirits of God in Isaiah. And, you know, people have been at that for ages. So, there we are.
They could have just counted them.
Yeah, that's very true. Another possibility is that in the Sea of Galilee, there were 153 different species of fish.
Yeah.
So, again, it's about universality, everybody. Mm-hmm. Every single thing you think. Mm-hmm. Don't go there. Two more things very quickly, which... I think as we come to the end of John, I don't know how you feel about him now, but I can remember thinking when I'd done my, I was coming to the end of my master's thesis, I thought I'm actually no further forward in understanding John than I was. And it's only actually as I was preparing this last week that a penny dropped for me. And I think it's this. If I were writing John's Gospel, I would do it like this. I would do it logically with a series of points. But what we actually said, do you remember we talked about terminal typologies? John really bangs on about the Logos and pulls in Philo and all that. Never mentioned it after chapter 1. He talks in chapter 3 about the serpent lifted up in the wilderness. What an amazing picture. Never mentioned again. And he does that all the time. And it suddenly struck me that when I'm listening to a lecture or that or taking notes, that's how I want it. But other people take lecture notes like this. And I think that's what John does. I think that's what John is doing. And that's why I struggle so much with it, because you to try and force that into a logical thing. Maybe he wasn't a theorist learner like I am, whatever. But I think at the end of 6 weeks scratching the surface of John's Gospel, that to me sums up what it's all about. He just chucks stuff out. He doesn't particularly want it to be logical, but it is like that kind of big mind map. And one of the most famous commentaries on John's Gospel from last century talks about the problem of John's Gospel. And that's the problem. You just can't force it into that logical thing, because he just chucks out a few ideas and doesn't follow them up or pursue them. That's what we're left with. So whether we can have that as a hashtag as we come to the end of the series, I think probably not. But we certainly need to be sure-footed and all the rest of it.